And you are listening to KKCR, Hanalei, KKCR, the station that loves you. And we do love you. We do love you. And this is Felicia and Marshall with Kauai Soapbox. And in the studio with me today is my friend Kumu Kauaiiki, who's going to help co-host this show on lots of different topics.
Welcome.
Yes. Aloha.
Aloha.
And aloha, Felicia.
Yeah. And today's show, we're going to have a lot of room for callers, 826-7771. We're going to be discussing a whole range of topics. I mean, we usually do, but there's so many, and I will just own that, gosh, I've been to so many meetings, and it's almost heartbreaking to go to a lot of these policy meetings because we have some intractable problems. It's a little bit difficult, but we'll have a happy show still yet.
Yeah, okay. We're going to get into that later.
Yeah, we'll get into that later. And then our first caller is going to be our U.S. Representative, Tulsi Gabbard.
So, oh, really?
Yeah.
So wow.
She's going to call in a little bit.
Yay.
Okay, so Kauai Soapbox is made possible by listeners like you in partnership with the Kauai Store, Pono Pies, and we're going to hear a little bit about our fun drive, and it is not too early to be calling in and donating, and for people who are really like to be honoring whichever shows they want to donate to, when they call in, they could say, I want to give, you know, $50 towards the Homegrown Garden Island Bluegrass Show.
That's right.
And
for example.
Yeah. And if they want to do $50 in Richard Sagan's Celebration Life of Life, honoring, you know, who we just lost, one of our programmers, or whatever they want to do, because it can all come together in the end, too, if they want to be an angel donor. So there's all kinds of beautiful ways people can have lots of good things that happen.
Right. It all goes to the same place, but it's a way to honor and celebrate the services.
Yeah. We have some sort of, like, fun, happy ways that we try and each encourage each show to have, you know, hit a certain mark. But it really all goes to the same place. And there's just that Donate Now button on there, too. And the more we start off the fun drive with a little push on the beginning, so that's why we really like Hanalei Bay Resort, that's given us a couple free nights for, you know, the pick and the fun early bird.
For the early bird drawing, yeah. Yeah, so you can go to kkcr.org right now and hit that Donate Now button if you just want to get it over with.
Yeah, or they can call 826-7774.
Yeah.
Because that's the office. And, so it goes well like that. So thank you so much. So let's hear from our underwriters. And these folks, these good folks, they keep us going all the time.
The views and opinions expressed during this program are those of the speaker and do not necessarily reflect those of KKCR, its management, staff, board, members, volunteers, or underwriters.
The Kauai Store is located in Kapa'a on the highway in front of Kostilas. The store has authentic Kauai products, including clothing, snacks, art, coffee, crafts, and more. We even have local food samples. The Kauai Store products are also available online at thekauaistore.com.
Pono Pies, dedicated to restoring breadfruit as a major food crop in Hawaii. Gluten, dairy, and GMO-free. Delicious Pono Pies, available at health food stores throughout Hawaii. PonoPies.com, 808-283-3718.
KKCR's Fall Fun Drive will begin on November 2nd. Starting now, you are invited to make a tax-deductible donation to KKCR, which will automatically enter you into our Early Bird Drawing. The Early Bird Drawing winner will win a two-night stay at the majestic Hanalei Bay Resort in Princeville. Mahalo nui to the Hanalei Bay Resort for their generous donation to our Early Bird Drawing winner and for supporting Kauai Community Radio. KKCR is volunteer-driven and listener-supported. We depend on your support to stay on the air. Our goal for this drive is $60,000. Help us get there by making a sustaining or one-time donation today. For more information on the Early Bird Drawing Prize and to donate securely online, visit kkcr.org or call us at 826-7774.
And mahalo for supporting Kauai Community Radio.
Right. So that's donate by November 1st, enter the early bird drawing, and a goal of $60,000. We can do that.
So that's a week from tomorrow.
Yeah. Okay.
So that's really wonderful. And I want to, let's see, we've got a caller already. So we can take her. All right, so we're going to take her. Aloha, you're on the air. Hello?
Aloha, this is Tulsi.
Hey, Tulsi, thank you so much for calling.
Thank you. It's wonderful to speak to you and all your listeners.
We appreciate it. KKCR, Kauai Community Radio, really appreciates how much support you give to our station by helping people understand what's going on, you know, all on the island. What's going on for you right now? What's on your mind?
Well, we've got a pretty big day coming up tomorrow. We are going to be welcoming a large number of Filipino World War II veterans and their families here at the U.S. Capitol, where history is going to be made in finally the United States government recognizing these brave heroes with the Congressional Gold Medal, which is the highest civilian honor that Congress can give to someone. I passed a bill in the House. Maisie Hirono passed a bill in the Senate. We had to get over 290 members of Congress to sign on and vote for it in the House. So this has been a long time coming, something that our Filipino community in Hawaii has fought for years and years, and that these Filipino veterans have been waiting for decades. So tomorrow we're going to be standing in Emancipation Hall. This is also where our King Kamehameha statue is, and we're going to gather with these veterans and provide them with this honor, the same honor that was given to heroic units like the Tuskegee Airmen, as well as Hawaii's own 442nd 100th Infantry Battalion, our Nisei veterans. I'm very much looking forward to it.
Can you give us a little bit of backstory on this particular group of people? Were they always Americans the way our Nisei veterans were, the 442nd, or were they immigrants? Or,
you know, this is a different situation because, you know, back in World War II when we had U.S. forces in the Philippines, these Filipino soldiers, they were not Filipino Americans or American citizens. These are Filipino soldiers who were asked to serve alongside and fight alongside our American troops there in the Philippines. And so many of them did. They put their lives on the line. Many of them gave up their lives in this service. The United States government promised them recognition and promised them certain benefits at that time. And then just a short few years later, the U.S. government essentially broke that promise and did not uphold the commitments that they made to these veterans. So some of these veterans made their way to the United States over the years. Just a few months ago on Kauai, I met one of these World War II Filipino veterans named Sixto Tabay and his wife. General Taguba's father was among these warriors. There are so many of them, both in the United States and the Philippines and other parts of the world, really, who have not been asking for recognition for themselves, but really for their brothers who gave their lives in this battle, and for their family members. You know, the pride that their spouses and their children and grandchildren have for them is really incredible. So just providing this recognition really, really means a lot to them, and it means a lot to us as a community that celebrates the contribution that our Filipino community provides to all of us.
And I recall that you have been working on this for several years.
We have been working on this. Congress actually only passes one or two Congressional Gold Medal awards every year. So, you know, I can't even count how many members of Congress, you know, put forward their own group that they're hoping to get recognized with the Congressional Gold Medal every year. The standards are quite high. You have to have almost 300 co-sponsors in the House and I believe over 75 co-sponsors in the Senate. So very few actually make the cut, and thankfully we were able to get this done for our World War II Filipino veterans.
And have their grandchildren at least been able to take advantage of what was promised to them? If they weren't given citizenship, have their children or down below, you know?
In some cases, yes, but in many cases, no. The promises that were broken were never remade. They were never passed on to future generations. So many of these World War II veterans are actually still waiting to be reunified with many of their immediate family members who are still in the Philippines. We were able to work with the Obama administration on actually getting a special dispensation for World War II Filipino veterans to kind of bypass the red tape that had made it. So these families were waiting for over 20 years just to be reunited. So they have this program called a parole that will give a special dispensation for the relatives, the immediate relatives of these World War II Filipino veterans. But again, this is something that was somewhat temporary. The Obama administration put in place, and so we've been encouraging all of our Filipino veterans in Hawaii to contact us, and we can put them in touch with the right people to be able to help them take advantage of this.
Well, I want to thank you for all the support that you consistently give to our veterans here on Kauai, and I'm sure throughout the islands. I have been more recently having some focus with the Veterans Center. We have the Vietnam Veteran Party coming up.
It's a big one that they're hosting there. As you know, the 50th anniversary of the Vietnam War is happening this year, and for our Vietnam veterans, especially those who served in a very difficult time and who came home without the kind of welcome and appreciation and thanks that we see for our veterans now, I think commemorating and thanking them for their service, with which they're still bearing many scars from, is important. And I'm so glad that they're putting together such a wonderful commemoration there on Kauai.
Yes, so I am looking forward to going. That is November 11th, which is Veterans Day, and it's going to be at the Marriott. And people can call the Veterans Center to get tickets. And so that is a wonderful event that I'm looking forward to being at. And we appreciate all the different ways that people can call your office, right, if they are having trouble getting their veteran benefits or any troubles with
that? Absolutely, absolutely. You can reach my office at 808-541-1986. That's 808-541-1986. Or if you're connected and you'd rather reach out to us via the internet, you can go to my website at gabbard.house.gov. That's gabbard.house.gov. And there's a place that you can fill in the form right there on the website to request for personal assistance.
Yes. So I have seen you here helping people, and Kaulana Finn does a very good job working on that. I'm happy to say that tomorrow at our county council, you may or may not know this, but they're making a committee on the council that is looking after veterans' interests. So I'm glad.
That's fantastic. I was not aware.
I'm glad to see that there is a greater focus going on that. And what we are looking at tomorrow, too, appreciating you for where you jump in for us. We're looking at our infrastructure, housing, and water issues. And in the housing, we have still yet houseless veterans. We have a chronic houseless problem here. So we're working on those. And but, you know, it seems any issues that affect the general population seem to have a highlighter and an underline underneath it for the veteran population. So
that's exactly right. These are issues that we've got to address, yes, for our veterans, but really for our entire communities, because so many people are being affected by those challenges on Kauai and all across the state.
Yes. So, yep, houselessness, I guess that's a global issue, really. We're seeing that. Are there any other key things that you would like to be sharing with the folks on Kauai in this moment?
Well, just Sure. Thanks for the opportunity, Felicia. I'll just mention one other thing before I go. On Thursday morning here in Washington, we're going to be holding a press conference with other members of Congress, along with leaders in the environmental community, people who are fighting for climate justice. We're going to be talking about the bill that I've introduced called the OFF Act. It's the OFF Fossil Fuels Act. Mm. And it really sets some very ambitious goals. It's really taking a page from Hawaii's legislation passed, which passed a few years ago, setting 100% renewable energy goals. And it really does this for the country. And it takes it at a very, it approaches this in a very systematic way, setting ambitious goals, but really providing the path and the process to be able to get there. For example, recognizing that in some of the communities in our country who are dependent on fossil fuel-based jobs or industries for employment, these are folks who can't be left behind. You know, so we've talked a lot about what happens in coal country, and when these, you know, these coal mines shut down, really the people in those communities are left behind struggling. So as a country, we've got to make sure as we make this important transition away from fossil fuels towards renewable energy sources, that we also take care of the folks whose livelihoods have depended on these industries. Right. And my bill seeks to address that.
I know we're seeing a big hit in that community in Texas, even when we've seen a lot of the infrastructure for that industry take a beating, literally, from the storm. And so it might be interesting in the wake of that damage if that we can't utilize that as an opportunity to move off it a little bit. I'm wondering, two questions for you. One is Puerto Rico. That has been a powerful lesson for us to be looking at the impacts that they've had as an island community, and seemingly a little bit of abandonment, you know. And when we look at the Puerto Ricans, even when I'm thinking about them, when you're talking about the veterans, there's a lot of veterans from Puerto Rico that have been, you know, we need to be honoring them as full-on Americans.
Yeah.
And helping them out over there. Have you had any focus on that?
Yeah, you know, I've been in touch with the delegate who represents Puerto Rico in the United States Congress. As you know, or you may know, that because Puerto Rico is a territory, like American Samoa and Guam and Saipan, they don't get a vote in Congress, mm-hmm. but their delegate is there to advocate for the people of our territories. And, you know, she's been obviously back and forth to Puerto Rico, bringing the voices of the Puerto Rican people back to Congress, calling for assistance both from the administration and from Congress. We passed an aid package for Puerto Rico, the U.S. Virgin Islands, as well as those who are still suffering and trying to recover from Hurricanes Irma and Harvey, as well as the California wildfires. We did this a couple of weeks ago, but it's not enough. You know, the people in these places in Puerto Rico and the Virgin Islands are still struggling without power. Most of their islands are still not connected to any kind of power, still having difficulty accessing drinking water and food. So we've got to continue to provide every available resource to them. And as you mentioned, see how we as a country can creatively support and empower these communities to rebuild in a way that will actually help to strengthen their resilience in the face of future disasters, and to do so in a way that is clean and will actually help them, not just for the short term, but for the long term. So I think about Hawaii as well when I look at what's happening in Puerto Rico as an island state. You know, we've got this should be further motivation for us to even more aggressively pursue energy and food security so that we're not reliant so much on the ships coming in, bringing our goods, so that we can be more safe and secure in the most basic necessary ways.
Yes, that's what I is my big takeaway. We are so much more isolated than is Puerto Rico, and if they're on their own for a lot of their issues, like their power and all that, you know, how much harder would it be for us? Although we have quite a big base here, so I would have to think that we wouldn't be kind of left out in the cold in quite as much of a way as at least it, if what I'm hearing in the press is correct, it seems like we have not been as helpful to Puerto Rico.
Well, I think that Puerto Rico was already going through a very difficult economic situation and challenge, which in many ways resulted in a lot of failing basic infrastructure, which has only worsened the problems that they have there. I think some of the response was too slow and inadequate in many ways. There are more and more resources being sent to Puerto Rico, but again, when the challenge is that they can't get someplace because the roads are impassable, you know, we're talking about very, very basic infrastructure problems that are occurring in many different parts of the island there. So, you know, again, we've got to get past and support the people of Puerto Rico during this immediate emergency, during this immediate crisis, but also not forget that we've got to be there for them as they build towards a longer-term stable future.
Yes. Thank you for that. There was a caller who had a question for you. Marshall, what was the question?
Yeah, aloha, Tulsi. A caller wanted to ask about the tax overhaul that's being proposed there in Washington, and she just suggested that when we talk about a revenue shortfall and deficit spending, we should look at people who have occupations like running an Airbnb or actually a stock investor, that if they spend more of their more than 30% of their time, that they ought to be taxed on that as income, I guess. And I'm sorry.
Okay, because, that's a pretty complicated question.
Yeah, it
is. And it's late at night for her in Washington,
right,
D.C.,
right.
So maybe she can answer that a little bit, but I don't want it to become a big call-in session for her because I just appreciate that she did call. She's got to go to bed soon.
Right.
It's probably after 10.
Thank you, though.
Yeah.
No, thank you. Thank you, Marshall. And for the caller, thanks for the question. You know, tax reform is something that is on everyone's mind. Especially as we head towards the end of the year here, it's hard to say what's going to happen with tax reform because, like a few of the other initiatives that Trump and the Republicans have tried to get through Congress, they have not been able to find consensus even amongst themselves. So I frankly am not optimistic that this will come before us for a vote soon. I might be wrong, but I haven't seen the kind of collaboration that's necessary to be able to come up with a tax package that will actually pass both the House and the Senate. There's no question in my view that tax reform needs to take place in so many ways. There are many taxes that are being levied that shouldn't be. Perhaps taxes that we can look at in different areas. But what's going on right now is President Trump is meeting with the Republicans, some of the Republicans on tax reform. To my knowledge, Democrats are not being included in that conversation. And really the only way we're going to be able to get something through that can make a meaningful, positive change for everyday Americans is if we come together and try to find some consensus on this. Otherwise, I think it's going to be a lopsided effort that will favor only the very few, leaving the rest of the country behind. So stay tuned on that one.
Well, thank you. Thank you for that quality response to the question. So
thank
I appreciate
you,
your call in, and have a wonderful day with the
Sounds
people
good.
Tomorrow.
Let's do this again soon.
Yes. All right.
Thank you,
Tulsi.
All
right, and I hope to see you guys. I don't know yet where I'll be on Veterans Day, but we're trying to work it out, and I'm hoping that I can be there for the evening Vietnam Veterans event.
That would be wonderful.
Wonderful. Aloha. Thank you both so much. I hope the weather is starting to dry up for you guys. I know it's been raining and flooding in a lot of places.
It's been raining definitely very hard, but it's for us today, it's been clearing up, you know. The sun shines again.
A break to spread some gravel in the driveway. Thanks, Tulsi. Good. Hope to see you soon.
Thank you, guys. Aloha.
Aloha. So, hey, Kumu.
Hi.
Hi.
Aloha.
Thank you for coming in here. There's so many topics, and you're part Filipino too, yeah? Did you have any ancestors in the wars?
I probably did, but I'm not sure who they were.
Okay.
I mean, I had some cousins that went to Vietnam, and that's what I can remember. I know some of my other uncles went to the Korea War and stuff like that. But when my cousin came home from Vietnam, he brought this picture album, and I remember thumbing through there, and there were pictures of all the people that died, and, you know, I mean, it was kind of horrendous and horrible pictures, but I was really shocked, kind of like, wow, what are they doing standing with all these, you know, parts and limbs of bodies?
Oh my.
It was pretty bad.
Oh, no, I didn't know that. I didn't understand that.
Yeah, so no, these are images from what? A war?
The Vietnam War.
It was the Vietnam War. My cousin, his name was Berto, and he came back with this album of he and his entire company, you know, they took pictures as they were going to go out to battle, and after the battles, they showed all the spoils of the battles and all the people who were dead and dying on the ground. Mm. It was really horrible, actually, but I was like 5 or 6 years old when I saw it, and I was kind of surprised and kind of silenced by the pictures that I saw, and you know, there they were, the soldiers holding the guns, and then right below them on the ground was all the dead people lying there, all busted up with bullets and whatever.
Mm.
It was kind of horrible, quite horrible, but you know, I think I was too young at that time to really know what was going on. I was just interested to see because I thought, oh, I wonder if I'm going to have to go to the next war or if the war is going to continue on until I get to be an adult. You know, thankfully, when I became an adult, there was no wars to get drafted for.
Right. Vietnam was like the end of the draft time.
And yeah, we did have to register. Did you register?
Yeah, I did register for the draft, and I graduated in 1980, and I think that's when about the time that the draft registration started. So I did register, but thankfully there was no wars going on at that time.
Well, we've been in continuous war. There's been no draft.
Yeah. Thankfully the draft wasn't instituted.
Right, and it really has made a very big difference on the policy and the tolerance of war in the country, because when people were drafted, and it was mostly the economically needy who ended up having to go, because those who had a little bit more money were able to somehow find a way to have a deferment. Though that wasn't complete. You know, there were certainly people across the economic spectrums that did go. I think because it was not voluntary enlistment, it got to the jugular of everyone in a different sort of way. But the good thing about a draft is I think that people engage more and they work to stop the wars. Like with Afghanistan, we've been there for 16 years.
That's right. When the public doesn't have to feel the effects of the war, when people in general aren't suffering in any particular way, American people don't really, you know, get up in arms about it. But if...
No pun intended.
Yeah, right. I didn't even realize. But yeah, right. If the toll of the war is spread out more evenly among the population, it seems like historically there's more concern. Yeah, there's sort of this like default draft now, right? It's not, you know, legally that everyone is, you know, liable to be called up. But those who are, you know, it's basically a draft of people who can't afford to do much else.
Yeah, there is still essentially an economic draft. There
might
be some people, may choose to go in, but there is very much an economic draft, like people who have struggled to get out of a community or an economically difficult situation. Very often their best choice is to go into the military. And I wanted to, it's a kind of a good moment to bring up something that I saw. I want to make sure I get the facts straight on it. So I'm trying to pull the article up in front of me, but there has been a change in, like, it's not quite the called the War Powers Act. Let me pull it up what the name of it is. I have it almost in here. Authorization to use military force. That was a special piece that came after 9/11, the incident that happened in New York City and the Pentagon. So they had something called the authorization to use military force that perpetuates and expands the presidential powers. And one would think as we would get away from 9/11 that they would start to be sundowning that from 2001, but it keeps escalating. Mm-hmm. And so what happened this week is that they have changed the wording that allows the military to pull in retired officers or retired soldiers. They don't even just have to be officers. They can bring back people into the military after they have completed their contract.
Right.
So that's pretty tough. If you have a contract and you're in there for 10 years or whatever it is, and then you have a retirement window where you're in the reserves and you're done with that, you should be retired rather than able to be pulled back in.
That's interesting. It seems like there must have been some clause in the contract. You just immediately turn around and, I don't know, change a law and everybody's retired military contract is altered.
It's no longer, it's not the case. But what they were looking to do is they apparently don't have enough pilots in the Air Force. So they want to be able to recall up to 1,000 retired pilots for up to 3 years was the direct reason. And I did look at the source documents on this a lot of times. I read an article like this, and I really kind of click through to the legislative statement in case it's essentially clickbait or they don't give the right information. But it basically lifted it for all areas of the military. Not even just that one particular aspect.
I wonder what the retirement age, the average retirement age of a fighter pilot is. Are these 20-somethings, 30-somethings, 40-somethings?
Yeah. I actually don't know.
Yeah, no.
I don't know. I mean, you know, pilots do a good job for a long time, although that's not the same thing as a fighter pilot. But there's a lot of other reasons to be flying a plane in the military than to be having a battle in the air.
Oh, for some reason I thought they were all fighter pilots that we were talking about.
Well, it says Air Force pilots. And you are listening to KKCR, Hanalei, KAQA, Kilauea, the station that loves you. And we're going to hear just a little bit about elderly affairs, and then I want to move into our next segment with the mission statement of Kauai Community Radio, especially because Butch Kekahu was one of your uncles, Kumu, and we're going to be hearing a little bit, because he is one of the founders of the station.
The Agency on Elderly Affairs in Kauai's ADRC, Aging and Disability Resource Center, is announcing Medicare open enrollment beginning October 15th through December 7th. Please be aware of scammers who may call you offering bogus services to get your Medicare information. If you're not sure the call is legitimate, hang up. Never respond to open solicitations for Medicare-covered supplies or services, and only provide your Medicare number to healthcare providers or facilities when you're actively seeking service. If you need assistance on selecting a Medicare plan or have any questions about Medicare, please contact the County's Agency on Elderly Affairs at 241-4470 or visit their office, 444 Rice Street, Suite 330. They're open Monday through Friday from 7:45 to 4:30.
Ke ala nu'ukia a KKCR. KKCR's mission statement. O KKCR ka hui leki o ku o ko'a no Kauai. He hui leki o kaiaulu e pai pai ia ai e ka lehu lehu ai ho'olele ana me ka ho'olaha ole. KKCR is Kauai's independent radio station. A community radio station supported by the people and broadcasting without commercials. Na pahuhopua KKCR. The goals of KKCR. E ho'olu I ka hoi, e a oaku, a e ho'ohau oli ho'i I na hoa ho'olohe. To encourage, to teach, and to also cause enjoyment in the listeners. E ma'alama, e ho'omau, I ho'olau le apu ina mea a me kanohona Hawaii. To care for, to perpetuate, and to celebrate Hawaiian customs and lifestyle. Ho ike kanani a kea o koka ko kayaulu a me ke kayaulu ku waho. Showcase the broad beauty of our community and the outside community. He kahua o KKCR no na leo a me na mele laha loa pu no me kalaha ole. O KK Kahu Foundation, ka mea e ho'oholo ai ia mau papahana leki o. KKCR is a platform for voices and songs both well known and underrepresented. The Ke Kahu Foundation facilitates these radio programs.
And mahalo for supporting Kauai Community Radio. So, kumu kawaiiki.
Hi.
I am happy to have you in here and help me discuss a number of these topics that I know that you are ma'a on quite a few of them.
Ma'a.
Ma'a means?
Ma'a means accustomed to.
Accustomed to.
Or used to.
Knowledgeable about.
Knowledgeable
about. Smart about. And ma'a. You are one of the few people that I know in your 50s. That actually can olelo, that can speak.
Ai, hiki au.
Yeah. So were you able to understand our mission?
Ai.
Ai, what did you think?
I think that's really beautiful. We'll make it iloa.
Good.
You know, I think of Uncle Butch Kaho. I think around the late 80s, early 90s, when the anniversary of the overthrow was coming to pass on Oahu, I was in school at the University of Hawaii at that time and often attended a lot of rallies and stuff, and I would often see him there, and he would always tell me, you know, we are a relative, you know, and he would start to tell stories about my grandparents and my great-grandparents who lived up in Olokele Valley and kept telling me, yeah, you guys are our Ohana and family, and I remembered that name, Ke Kahu, and so I was really proud to know that when I came back home to Kauai, there was this KKCR, and it was one of his dreams to have this station. So I'm really proud to be here. This is my first ever time at this radio station. So I'm really proud to know that he had a hand in this. And when I sit here and look around, I can only think of his daughter, Ruby, who I always see around here and there. And you know, we love to talk story, and it's just amazing to see how something has grown to fruition, I believe. You know, this started small, and to me now, KKCR really is doing a lot of things that no one else is doing on the island, you know, and allowing people to come and share their mana'o, share their music, you know, popular or unpopular. I think it's a great thing, because then that's really empowering to the community. And that's what I look at, you know, that people in the community are empowered. And in being empowered, they empower everybody else. You know, if the local people or the Kanaka Maoli people are empowered, then we all move up, you know.
Right. We all get better together.
That's right. You know, in our family, the tradition we lived by was aloha ikikahi, to love one another, kokua ikikahi, help one another, and malama ikikahi, which is to take care of each other. So we are our brothers and our sisters' keepers. You know, if there are people in need, then we're always there to help, to kokua. And kokua means, like, not just help, but is to make the lives of people easier, to just do it without being asked, yeah, really.
Yeah, it's like extending from the heart, right?
Yeah.
It's extending.
Definitely, you know, our heart is endless, you know, it's what they call that aloha palena ole, it's boundless love that Hawaiian people and in Hawaiian culture, they were able to give without expecting something in return, for instance. You know, and it's up to the people now to continue the things that they have been taught, to share and spread this around so that it can grow and be nurtured in our community today. You know, a lot of our kupunas have passed on and left us and charged us with certain things to take care of. And for me personally, you know, before my tutus died, they said, we want you to take care of this. Take care of the hula. Take care of the arts and the crafts. And to continue these things so that the other generations that they will never see will be able to benefit from their knowledge and their wisdom, their mana'o. And so I have no choice but to do what they said to me, you know, that it's in your hands now. And when they passed away, we moved up to the next level, you know.
And how did you gain the gift of the language? Because you are in that middle generation that,
right.
like, people who are your grandparents' age, they heard it from their parents, and
right.
they spoke it some. And kids now are growing up with it in the immersion schools, but you weren't in any of that. Where
no,
did you
I
get it?
No, I was not. I was really fortunate that I was like a toy that was passed between my grandmother and her brothers and sisters. They all spoke Hawaiian fluently, and because I was around them, I learned certain words, certain phrases. I understood what they were saying. But when other people came, they'd speak English. Other people came, and they'd go right into their Hawaiian. But fortunately, because I'd been around all of those people, I knew what was being said. I was also blessed to be raised around the people of Ni'ihau, for instance. It was all the children of Ni'ihau who really taught me a whole lot more, or what made me understand, because their speaking was a little bit different from how my tutu spoke. But that's how I was really thrown into learning the language and wanting to know more, really. I was fortunate to go to school. I went to University of Hawaii and graduated there.
Did you go to Kapaa or did you go to Waimea?
I attended Waimea High School. Actually, I was a Waimea High School dropout when I was about 15 or 16. Uh-huh. And then I dropped back in, and I had to take all major subjects. They didn't let me have any electives. Except for, like, I had chorus. That was my only elective. By my senior year, even though I had dropped out, like, 10th and 11th grade, I was already attending KCC. I was an early admit student to KCC, me along with Sandra Sagisi from Kauai High School, and one other girl, I believe. We were early admit to college, and we were really successful there.
And did they have a Hawaiian studies program there at that time?
There was no Hawaiian studies program at KCC at that time. They had Hawaiian language classes, Hawaiian culture classes, but not really a Hawaiian studies kind of major or anything like that. So I actually got my associate degree in, what is that, the broad subject?
Liberal arts.
Yeah, liberal arts. And after I graduated from KCC in my liberal arts degree, I had this strong desire to go to college at the University of Hawaii. And I was really fortunate because I had no money to go to college. I didn't apply for scholarships. But I knew this lady. Her name was Kapiolani Miller. And one day I was traveling around with her, and we went to this apartment that overlooked the University of Hawaii. And I stared at the university, and I told myself, one day I'm going to go to the school. I want to come here and learn and be nurtured, you know, and let my mind expand. And she overheard me talking to myself. And she said, what, you want to go to school? I said, yeah, I do want to go to school. And she said, well, she told me, you get the application and sign up. And that was the first step. So I signed up. When I got my acceptance letter, she said, okay, good. And she took me to Ala Moana, and she bought me new clothes, wardrobe, shoes, shirts, pants, everything that I needed. She paid for my tuition for me.
Mm.
She bought all my books for me.
Wow.
And then she put money in the bank for me and said, now you can go to school. Go and do whatever you can.
And what was her name?
Her name was Kapiolani Miller. Kapiolani Miller Toledo. I don't know if you know her. She was Miss Hawaii in 1954. She was 7'8" Hawaiian. She was one of the most beautiful people I knew. And I met her through some friends, and we became really close. I would accompany her around the islands, Oahu, Maui, Kauai, Oahu, Maui, Kauai.
And then you ended up doing all, like, even as you're sitting here talking, if the listener could see you, your hands are like, you're doing hula just as you're talking story, right? Mm-hmm. Your hands are dancing.
Hawaiians, we like to talk with our hands, not just our mouth. Our
but
whole body moves.
Very gracefully.
Mm-hmm.
Very gracefully, very beautifully. Yeah. So you have run around the world a bit.
Really, I really have, and I've been really fortunate to leave Kauai and actually return back alive, you know, because I'll tell you, the first time that I left Kauai and I left the state of Hawaii, I think I went to Japan that first time.
With a halau?
I was traveling along with a halau and Te Kapukini Maka and their halau, Nahula Oka Ohiku Kapulani. They were doing the Kauai Loves You promotion. And so they had, I remember David Ueno was the president of the Kauai Visitors Bureau. And we traveled throughout Japan, going through all the major cities and some smaller cities. We went to an expo. I think it was it was an expo in the southern part of Japan. But one of the highlights was going to Hiroshima, which I always heard the stories of what happened in Hiroshima, the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. But we attended this summer festival. There was 800,000 people present. And I was the finale of the show. They had mm-hmm. all the top stars of Japan singing and performing in that. Then we did a Polynesian show. And at the end of the show was the Fire Knife Dance, and I was the Fire Knife Dancer. And I was the finale of the show. Right from there, they started a two-hour firework and laser show, and which was the most fabulous thing. All of the halau members got to sit on the main stage with all the stars and watch this. When the show was over, we had to go and make the bus, and this is like wall-to-wall people all along the side of the Hiroshima River, which is huge. And we had to lock our arms in a chain to walk through the crowd so we wouldn't lose anybody. And we had to go along the banks of the river where there was like stairs, but there was so many people stuck over there. We decided we would crawl up to the grass, and that's what we did. We crawled through the grass instead of going through the stairway to find our bus on the other side, which thankfully we did find our bus, because the crowd was just outrageous. There were so many people, I couldn't believe it. But it was such a great festival and such a great feeling to be in that city at that time. We got to go to the Peace Memorial Center or the park, the Peace Park. And when we went there, I remember seeing at every where they had the different statues mm-hmm. of different things and every monument. They had thousands of leis made of tiny Japanese cranes that were made by the school children of Japan. Mm-hmm. And that stood in my mind because it was like trash bags full of these leis. And it was just, I couldn't believe it. And, mm-hmm. you know, it was overwhelming to go there and to travel through Japan. I was so fortunate. Went from the north all the way down to the south. And spreading the news of aloha from Kauai to invite visitors to come. We stopped at all the government offices and we exchanged omiyage with them.
Omiyage?
Yeah, omiyage are like gifts, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
And so we brought gifts for them and they gave us gifts. We did performances wherever we went. And then at this expo that we did, we not only performed, but we did, we demonstrated Hawaiian arts and crafts. And mm-hmm. I was, of course, demonstrating lei making. And people came from all over to be a part and do this. And so there were some people that came there and they saw me doing this lei making and they said, oh, we'll send you some flowers. And so mm-hmm. when I went back to my hotel room, they had sent huge bouquets of flowers to my room, of flowers from Japan. So I took those bouquets back to the expo, and I took them all apart, and I made beautiful leis out of the flowers from Japan. And when they saw their flowers made into beautiful leis, they were just blown away. And I was just blown away by receiving that, you know. Because I was a fire knife dancer, I was the only one in the company that had their own room. Everybody else had to share, but I was on high standing, I guess.
Well, even on an extension on that, like just this weekend before last, when I was up there at the Emelani Festival with you, and there was two halau who came from Japan.
Yes.
And being able to watch their joy at basically taking wildflowers and just the leaves from the trees and learning how to just harvest from the forest to make the leis. Like, they had never done something bought them. And that was a beautiful thing for them.
Yeah, I was really happy that this year we performed, not just with my halau, but the halau kapa hula o hululani, which is from Oahu, my hula sisters. And then their sister halaus, two different halaus from Japan. I believe one was called Le'a Hula Studio, but I'm not sure of the other one. But altogether, of the Japanese contingent that came, there were nine women that came from two different halaus, and they arrived the day before. And as soon as they arrived, we went straight into rehearsal, started doing things, and then went from there to a small excursion, picking and coming back and to make our leis, because the event was held the next morning, 9 o'clock start. Mm-hmm. And so it was really beautiful. It was a beautiful experience, not just for me, but I know for them, they really treasured it. And I could tell just by the look on their face that they really benefited from that. And to be able to be in Hawaii with some Hawaiians that, you know, and it was really real. It was the realest experience. I really am blown away by the fact that in Japan, there are millions of people engaging in the hula today. Millions of them. They have 6 hula magazines. Mm. Hawaii, we don't even have 1 million people, do we? Or maybe we have 1 million.
We have 1.3 million.
Oh, we get 1.3 million. Well, there's 3 million in Tokyo alone doing the hula.
What?
3 million in Tokyo alone doing the hula.
Really?
That's not including the rest of the country. Hula have become the biggest thing in Japan. And, you know, when I think about the hula, you know, in the ancient days, hula was really reserved, and only the chosen few were allowed to even become hula dancers, let alone watch the hula. And then, you know, it went through a different stage and almost got lost, but it was preserved underground by the hula practitioners. And today, hula have become the world's dance of love, really. The kupunas died with all of the ancient restrictions, taking that with them, freeing us to be able to learn, to teach, and to share this mana'o, not just with only Hawaiian people, but with anybody in the world. And hula is one of those things that, you know, usually if you're going to take some other form of dance, Japanese dance or whatever, you're going to have a Japanese person teaching you or some other person teaching you, yeah? Today, hula is taught by Hawaiians and non-Hawaiians alike. Hawaiian language, Hawaiian history, Hawaiian culture is all being spread and taught by not just Hawaiians, but all the people who love Hawaii.
And how do you say aloha in Japanese?
How do you say aloha in Japanese?
Because we got a lot of people from Japan listening right now.
Oh, really?
I can tell.
So I'm not sure how you say aloha in Japanese.
Konnichiwa,
that means hello.
Yeah.
Yeah, but that's really...
Right.
One of the things that I would like to say is that it doesn't mean aloha, but kawaii means beautiful. And when they hear the name of our island, Kauai, they relate it with being beautiful.
Yeah. Well, just in case any of the people from Japan that are listening right now were part of the people who were with us last week, I want to give them an extra hello, because
yes,
I see we've got quite a good number of people who tuned into just this show from Japan.
Oh, so how beautiful. It's, what can I say?
Yeah, so that's
Yoroshiku onegai shimasu.
And then... when you went over there the first time, how old were you then?
I believe I was in my 20s.
So that was the time of the Renaissance, yeah, of the Hawaiian Renaissance.
Yes, I'm sure. I grew up during that Renaissance period. From 1973, I began to attend boarding school at Kamehameha.
Oh, you went there?
Mm-hmm. I went to attended boarding school at Kamehameha in 1973 to 1978, and then I returned to Kauai.
Oh, I see.
Yeah. I didn't graduate from there, but I gained a lot of knowledge and information that I needed. And I feel really accomplished that I actually graduated from the University of Hawaii, something that I never thought I would ever do, but I did. And I never ever thought I'd become like a kumuhula or a teacher. It just happened on me.
And who were your main teachers for making leis or for hula? How did you learn
Well, you know,
that?
My making leis was a different thing. It was kind of a spiritual experience. As a child, I began to have dreams about lei making. I saw the flowers, the hands weaving it, and then I heard them saying the names of this and the names of that. And so when I went fishing and hunting with my dad, I recognized the plants. I said, those are the plants. And I automatically went there and I began weaving these things because I had seen it done. And after I was done, I would always take these leis to the grave of my great-grandmother, who later I found out she made these things. And then her husband was the kumuhula. Mm. And for years, our family thought all of the chants that he had held were lost forever when he died. While I was working at the Bishop Museum Archives, I saw a yellow post-it note on one of the computers, and I said, how come my great-grandfather's name is on there? And they punched it and said, oh, there's 78 chants in the Helen Roberts collection.
Wow.
That your grandfather contributed, and I was just blown away. And then, of course, I went and checked it out, and, you know, and I told my family about it. And so we were able to see these things and to read all of these things that he had left behind. Unfortunately, his chants, there was no wax recordings made of it or that survived. But a lot of the words to many different chants, and a couple of the chants I remember being published in the book Namele Velo. And one of them is called Maika'ina Kuahibi. It's about the mountains. Wonderful is the mountains, and it takes you around the whole island of Kauai.
If you want to do a chant, you are welcome to do it. I didn't prep you to do one, so you don't have to either.
I would do a portion of that chant. You know, like I said, Maika'ina Kuahibi is like a 75 long, line long chant. And most of the chants that I did find in the collection were like pages and pages and pages long, which was like you couldn't believe. How could anybody store that in their mind and remember all of that?
But what were they about?
They were all about the whole life and the lifestyle of the people, what things they did, where they went, you know, and all different occasions, from death to births to weddings. It spoke of all these different things. And the little excerpt that I would do is it takes you from Kalalau. And from Kalalau, going all the way around to the west, to Kekaha, and to finally end up at Waimea, where they lived. It goes like this. Ua puka ka ohu ka ayo Kalalau, la launa lima I ka paha paha le, o poliale. Aha ele ele I vai o kolo, ke o ne kani o nohili. Ho o lale ka lupua I ki ko o lau wahine, hala kau niu a kauna lewa I ka makani. Pi o ka lau o ka o hai kuhela I mana. Hana le alea I ke kaha, I wai o lama I ke ia ai, ka wai pale ule I liahi o wai mea. O ka wai ho la noia.
Wow, thank you so much.
Yeah, and so it's basically saying that how the clouds reach Kalalau and where the food is gathered by the hand and goes around to the different mountains to like Nohili the singing, the Barking Sands, and to Kekaha and to Waimea and the different valleys, Kolo Valley, and speaks to the plants, the Ohai Kuhela that grow at Mana.
And we had several callers. Are they calling on this topic, or?
A couple calls for Kumar. Yeah.
Hi.
One caller says he's a friend of yours, and the message is that the Ohe Hano Iho, the nose flute, yeah, from Koke'e, Jim, says hello.
Oh, aloha no. That's my friend Jim. I've known him over 20-something years. And he used to blow the conch shell, another conch shell, but the Ohe Hano Ihu, the nose flute for us when we would go on at Queen Emma.
Ah.
But I don't know. He's not even down up the mountain now, so he must be in Wailua or so. Aloha.
Yeah, you know.
Thank you for calling.
And the second thing is a caller who tuned in a little bit late and would like to hear your name again, Kumu Kawaiiki.
Yeah, my name is Kawaiiki, and it means little Kauai. I got that name from my grandmother, not when I was born, but when I came of age. And she gave me that name, and she gave me all the information. You know, she told me this whole story about this Johnny Appleseed person. He was like the Johnny Appleseed of Kauai, and he went around, and the people loved him because he planted all these plants that the people needed either for ceremony or survival or whatever it was for. And many of these plants that are growing, that he planted, are still growing today. And so he was important to be a farmer like that. And then there was a place, a platform called Kawaiiki for the hula. It was a rock that sat on the platform where in the evening time people would gather at Kawaiiki, and they would point to a vahipana or a sacred place on the rock, and Kawaiiki could tell you the story. He could sing, chant, and dance that story of the different places. And then they had a saying, Iike ole oi I kawaii me kawaiiki a ole oi iike, which means that if you've never seen Kawaiiki, then you've never seen the island of Kauai. And I was blown away. I didn't know that there was so much kuleana that goes with a name, you know.
So much responsibility.
Yeah,
Responsibility,
obligations, things that, you know, that you must do and accomplish. And I aloha my grandmother so much for having the foresight, for telling me this story, and to give me direction when I was, like, in the dark. She gave me direction and showed me where the light was and told me to follow the light. And since that time, I've just gone, you know, and done what they wanted me to do. I mean, all the things I do today are not just because I don't necessarily want to do these things. I do that because it's part of my kuleana, part of my responsibility and my obligation, not to myself, but to my culture and to the world.
And you're listening to KKCR Hanalei KAQA Kilauea. This is Felicia and Marshall with Kauai Soapbox, and we have Kumu Kawaiiki in the studio with us, helping us. In a moment, we will hear from our underwriters, but I want to stay with that thought there, Kumu. When your tutus tell you, because you, the tutus of the past, they tell you and you speak of it in the present, can you help us understand how that happens?
They tell me, say that again.
Well, like a lot, you're talking about what your tutus tell you, but these tutus have passed away. Are they speaking to you? How do they speak to you in the
presence?
You know, is it in a dream, or how do you?
They taught us to be very observant of nature and to recognize ho'ailona, that will reveal many of these things.
So those are signs of nature.
Yeah.
The ho'ailona
in nature.
Like a flock of birds flying away.
Either a flock of birds, the clouds, the wind, the sun,
the rainbow,
the water, the rainbows. She told me, for instance, that when she comes to me, she will come in the form of rain and rainbows, in the form of a gray cloud. And yesterday I was in Kilauea. It rained cats and dogs, and I was out there standing in the rain, and loving it, actually. As I sat and stood in the rain, I continued to weave. I was weaving coconut leaves, and I could feel the mana of my tutu being with me, and I felt the warmth of her heart, like, with me. And I hadn't gone to that beach, what is that, Kalihi Beach?
Kahili Quarry Kahili Beach. Kahili Beach.
Yeah, it was just a beautiful experience to go through, you know. I haven't come to North Shore a lot because lately, for the past few years, I've been living in the mountains.
In Kauke'i.
Up in Kauke'i, yeah.
Yeah, and then, okay.
We have a couple of callers holding. I have a caller question, too. Are you going to do
okay, so
of our
yes,
spots?
Yes, I will. Thank you. So, Kauai Soapbox is made possible by listeners like you in partnership with the Copper Man and Edible Hawaiian Islands.
KKCR Hanalei, KAQA Kilauea, K224CQ Anahola, K284AL Haleiwa.
The Copper Man. Copper, stainless steel, and galvanized aluminum. We specialize in ornamental and custom work and fabricate and install any kind sheet metal work, residential and commercial. Serving Kauai for over 30 years. We're still talking. HarryConti.com. That's HarryConti.com. Or 639-3456. PackYourTrash.org and SaveRCs.us.
Edible Hawaiian Islands is a subscription-based, advertiser-supported print and digital magazine, the only James Beard Award-winning food and drink magazine in the state of Hawaii. Edible Hawaiian Islands digital magazine may be enjoyed at ediblehi.com.
And mahalo for supporting Kauai Community Radio. So, Marshall?
Yes. So, a follow-up to the question on your name. Are you related to Butch?
Butch Kekahu, you mean?
I don't know.
Yes. That question, probably, oh, well.
Well, according to Uncle Butch, he said that he was our relative. He told me, yes, I'm your uncle, and I know all your tutu and your your grandparents, and I would go and stay at your great-grandparents' home in Olokele Valley.
Okay. And that call, I mean, I don't know, this is getting into your family and everything, but the caller actually wanted to know, which side of your family are you related to Butch?
To my mother's side.
Okay.
My mother's side, and through my great tutu, Kualu Nui.
Okay.
Kualu Nui was descended from the Menehune people, the chiefs of the Menehune.
Is that right?
Yeah. Our lineage traced all the way back to Kualu Nui Kiniakua and Kualu Nui Paukamoku, who were ali'i of the Menehune people, and lived up in the mountains and valleys, way in the backlands.
What kind of time frame are we talking about?
Oh, you remember when they had the last census in Wainiha Valley, where people were claiming to be Menehune?
I think that was in about 1906, somewhere yeah. like that, not too long after the 1900s.
Yeah.
That was our tutus that were claiming those things.
Yeah.
I think my great-grandfather, Kualu Nui, William Kualu, or William Kualu Nui, he lived to be 105 years old.
Wow.
And died around 1955.
Wow. Okay, we do have a couple callers holding, Felicia.
Sure.
Okay, let's take them. Aloha, thank you for holding. You're on the air.
Aloha.
Hi, you're on the air.
Oh, aloha. Aloha mai kako e Felicia me kawaiiki.
Hi, aloha no.
O Jody ko inoa.
Aloha, Jody.
Aloha. I have a question about your travels, Kawaiiki. And that was such a wonderful story about your trip to Japan. I wondered if you had been to other South Pacific islands, for example, Aotearoa.
Yes, I have.
Or Tonga or Samoa, if you could maybe share a little story about one of those island nations.
Well, I have been very fortunate to travel to different islands in the South Pacific. Firstly, I want to speak about my travels to Aotearoa. Recently, a group of students came from Aotearoa to participate in this year's Kauai Mokihana Festival. Their teacher was, she was what I call my sister. Her name is Joy Rogers, Faya Joy Rogers. I know her as Ualani, the name that I give her. The first time I went to Aotearoa was probably 1996 when I was present, when I was working for the Bishop Museum, and I was an intern studying how to become a curator. I got to travel down there to Te Papatongo River in Wellington, and I stayed with a woman named Afina Tamarapa, who was in the museum, and they were developing all their plans for the brand new museum that was going to be on the waterfront. When I got there, it was still the old museum on this, I think the hill is called Mauna Tapu or something like that. And I was brought there. They had a special pōwhiri, a ceremony of greeting to me. And the very first thing they would do was to bring me into the collections where this huge cape, it was the Cape of Kivala'o, that last year, I believe, was repatriated back to the Bishop Museum in Honolulu. Mm,
yeah.
I got to see that when I was there in 1996. I did a lot of museum quality photography of all the different items that I got to see. I got lists of all the different items, because these things would probably be some list that, you know, Hawaiian families, Hawaiian societies, anybody, the Bishop Museum might be interested in, you know. And I actually put together a whole slideshow on my travels in Aotearoa. Aotearoa has a collection of Hawaiian artifacts called the Omen Collection. They were the private collection of a collector in England, Mr. Oldman. And in World War I, his entire neighborhood was bombarded and flattened by the bombs. Only his house stood alone. And contained in his house were all these ancient artifacts, primarily from Hawaii, that were saved somehow, you know. And before Mr. Oldman's death, a curator from Te Papatongo River convinced him to sell this collection, or at least part of the collection, to the New Zealand government. And that's how it fell into the hands of the New Zealand government. Te Papatongo River is the main museum of New Zealand. Now, from the main museum, holds title to all these items which the Kivala'o Cape came from. But they have portions of the collection sent out to I think it's four other museums, the Auckland, the Christchurch, and Otago Museum on South Island. I got to go to North and South Island. When I was up in Auckland, I went to the Auckland Museum, and I photographed whatever Hawaiian stuff was in the collection there. I went down to Christchurch to the Canterbury Museum, where there was that drum. And you see this picture of the drum.
The Canterbury drum.
The human figures on it. Well, when I went there, they pulled the drum off of the collection, and I had my sister Rosa Parker. My sister Rosa Parker, she's not my real sister, but my Hanai sister.
Yes.
She was there, and she had my whangai. Her son was my whangai, or my adopted son. And they were the two witnesses, along with the curator there. I held a drum ceremony where they allowed me to play the drum. I played it.
Mm.
I played that drum. No one had ever played that drum in, I don't know, 100-something years or so. But they allowed me to take it off, and I had a drum ceremony, wrapping the drum in tapa and holding it there while we were having the ceremony. I mean, you know, you could feel all the tutus, the spirits of our ancestors just coming alive when we went through the different collections. And even when I played the drum, being in New Zealand was really, really fabulous. That was my first experience, you know, working in the museum. Then later on, I was brought to New Zealand to teach in different schools at New Zealand. Primarily, the first school, I believe, was in South Auckland. It was called Finlayson Park School, and the Maori component was called Te Huringa. And it was my friend Faya Joey that brought me there. I got to teach there. I got to go to different kohangareo, Punana Leo schools and share and teach there. I went and I taught at Kofi Intermediate also, and Mount Albert Grammar School in Auckland, right in the city. Yeah, and I got to meet people from many different iwi that I was there. And one of the iwi I would love to mention is the Tuhoi. The Tuhoi are the people of the mist. And So I actually got to go to Waikaremoana where the Tuhoi are from.
Lucky oi.
I was so lucky. I'm telling you, you know, when I went to these places, it was a privilege for me. I couldn't believe that I could go that far. And, you know, when I first journeyed out of Hawaii, my greatest fear was that I would die in another country, another land, far from Hawaii. So when I came back, believe you me, I kissed the ground that I lived on and walked on. I was happy to be back, but to be able to have gone there, and, you know, I went there time and time again, maybe 6, 7, 8 times, I guess. All told in New Zealand to teach and stuff, and it was fabulous. One of the things that stands out to me in New Zealand about me teaching was that I never had to I never had to teach the children how to sing the songs because they were so keen at listening and following and remembering that by the time I had, you know, finished teaching all the motions, they knew all the song too, because I would be singing and then they'd follow along, and I give them credit for being like that, so eleo and so lively about learning and just interested in learning, you know. This time when that group came from New Zealand, I was happy to share a chant that I had recently wrote for Kaumualii, and I would tell them the story of how our king was the last independent king of Kauai, and so this song was about all his royal birth, and I gave them all this information so that they could go back to New Zealand and they could tell them about Kauai and how Kauai was the last kingdom in Hawaii.
Fantastic.
Yeah, it was totally fantastic. I couldn't, you know, it just brings tears to my heart because I just think of this beautiful time, and they're trying to get me to go back to New Zealand again, and if I can get a babysitter, I would love to go again.
Maybe a little dog sitter?
Yeah, I need some dog sitters.
I was there at that performance, Kawaiki. You and I were trying to get in through the back door together.
Oh, that was you. Oh, my God.
I'm that English woman with the orange hair.
Yeah. No, you know, that was so fabulous.
What a wonderful story. It's Thank you so much for telling that.
Yeah. You know, and just that's just my story for, where's that?
Aotearoa.
Yeah. You know, I was also lucky to travel to Tonga, too. And in Tonga, I was adopted by a Tongan woman named Kaipa. She lived in Honolulu, and her husband was a noble. Her daughter was like a sister to me. Her name is Liu Waki, and she worked as an entertainer at Paradise Cove. And so one year, they said, oh, let's all go to Tonga. We're going to go. And our cousin, Marie, was having her 16th birthday in Tonga. And so we went there. And we actually stayed in Tonga about almost 2 months. And it was fabulous. It was the most beautiful time. Tonga is another place that if you want to learn about the monarchy and to visit a monarchy, Tonga was the last place you could go. And I'm not sure what kind of government they have in Tonga now, but when I was there for the 80th birthday of the king in Tonga during that time. Tonga was just absolutely fantastic. The friendly eyes, they are the friendly islands, and surely when you go there, you know, everybody's friendly. They all invite you to their house to eat. If they see you walking on the roadside, they'll pick you up. I mean, they're really, really friendly and nice. I got to experience not just the Tongan cuisine, but, you know, the Tongans, they keep all of their customs. They're just onipa'a, and they're steadfast about keeping their customs alive. And it was a fabulous trip. Tonga has many islands. We were primarily on the island of Tongatapu, which is the main island in Tonga. And our Hanai mothers come from the she comes from the village of Folaha, which at Folaha there's this huge lagoon, and it was the area where the chiefly people stayed there, and our Hanai mother Taipa had this beautiful little, it was a quaint home, but it was right along the lagoon there, and just beautiful, beautiful. And what I remember about Tonga is that wherever you went, there was pigs. Pigs with babies, little pigs running all over the place. And that for every pig, there was probably another kid that was running around on the streets. We were there when they had their first block party ever in Tongatapu there. It was just fabulous. Actually, I was there with Kumuhina. I don't know if you know who Kumuhina
is.
Yes, I do. Kumuhina and I were there, and I was entering her in a pageant, the Miss Galaxy pageant, and she won the pageant that year. So we became overnight sensation in Tonga. We were on the radio there as well. We couldn't walk one block without everybody wanting to stop and talk and take pictures. And you know, it was just fabulous. So I would definitely recommend anybody that wants to learn or wants to see a culture that still is surviving despite all Western transition to go there, because Tonga is where you'll see that still alive.
And Jody, thank you so much for your questions. I have other callers holding.
Yes.
Aloha, Jody.
Thank you both.
Aloha.
Aye, aloha. Aloha.
And this is KKCR Hanalei, KAQA Kilauea, Felician Marshall with Kauai Soapbox on Kumu Kauai Iki is our guest right now. We have another caller.
We do, but Kumu, I'm dying to ask you about Tonga and the agriculture there. Actually, how do they grow their food? Do they import most of it?
No, Tonga is a subsistence economy. Kalamai. You know, it's fabulous. They will have a whole grove of coconut trees growing. And then underneath that, they're planting all of those, the ufi, the yam, the manioca, taro, and I mean, there's no space left untended underneath there. Most people have their own plantations away from their houses like that. And then, you know, like for people who are fishers of the sea, if you go down to the harbor in the morning, there's an open market. People come with all the fish that they caught that night, and people who want to buy fish or crabs or lobsters, you go down there and you just buy it directly from the people. The markets, you know, they have kind of modern markets, but, you know, in Tonga, it's really like a third world country. But at the same time, it's so fascinating. And what's fascinating is that for me to see all brown people, all natives, doing all the different things. I mean, here in Hawaii, we have a diverse population, whereas in Tonga, they're mostly all Tongans there. But, I mean, some Tongans have intermarried. And one of my friends, what is his name? Salesi Kauli. The Kauli family owns all the bakeries in Tonga. And they have some bakeries in the other islands. But when I was there, he'd take me to a different bakery every day, and we could get whatever we wanted.
Can I get his number?
Oh, you can.
I'm happy.
Yeah. He just built a beautiful...
That sounds like a good tour.
Yeah. You know, I'm going to tell you, if you ever go there, just be prepared. You know, take a lot of gifts there, because, I mean, they like to have old Aloha shirts and shorts, pants, anything, because Tonga, you can't really buy that kind of stuff. So people from outside of Tonga send them old clothes or rummage sale clothes and stuff like that. But mostly, if you want to have, you know, nice clothes, Tongans are great handy workers. They can make everything in Tonga. Yes.
So maybe take some Levi's and trade them for a handmade.
If you have Levi's, they're gonna love it.
Yeah. Okay, I'm sorry. I've interrupted. Let's get our next caller on.
Okay.
That was great, though. Aloha. Thank you for holding. You need to turn your radio off. Is your radio off?
Hello.
Hi.
Thank you for holding. You've been
Hello.
Very patient.
Thank you. Yes.
Am I on air?
You are.
I am Catherine Music, and I wanted to thank this Kumu because he brought up ancestors. I'm Catherine Music, named after my grandmother and great-grandmother.
Aloha Nui.
And I want to thank, yeah, aloha. And he also, he mentioned because of the ancestors, I danced with Nahui Kamaka Okalani, and I lived in Okinawa for 11 years.
Oh.
So I'm embracing both Okinawa and Kauai. I lived here six. So thank you to Kumu for, one, bringing up Mamoe, our ancestors, and two, for saying share. Well, you have to share. I'm not Hawaiian, but I love to embrace
Hawaiian.
Are
you living in Hawaii now, though?
And the reason to call is I...
Then you're Hawaiian.
How do you say aloha in Japan? And I have, every time I email or chat with any of my friends in Japan and Okinawa, they are so excited to say aroha. So the answer to the question
is aroha.
Aroha. There is no word like aloha in the world. It embraces love and gratitude and understanding. And so the Japanese millions of hula dancers are craving something earthy and beautiful.
Right.
And so I am privileged to have experienced both Japan and Kauai. And so aloha.
Aroha.
There's no other word like it.
Yeah, I totally agree, you know.
Have you been to Okinawa?
I haven't gone to Okinawa, but Uncle Nathan and them, they all went to Okinawa on exchanges with the native people of Okinawa.
Nathan Kalama?
Yeah. Nathan Kalama was
the same story of the brown people trying to keep their old heritage.
That's right.
Very loving. I didn't want to leave because they're so loving.
Yeah.
And the community. And so they share. And you're sharing hula. And they come. And so that's all I'm calling on, a lovely, lovely feeling of aloha.
Right. Aloha.
And we say aroha.
Yeah.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
You're welcome. My pleasure.
Aloha.
I just want to add that, you know, saying aloha like that, years ago when I came back to the island of Kauai, about 3 days after I arrived, I had this dream vision. And in the dream vision, I saw people from all over the world, from all walks of life, young and old, men and women, and they're all singing and chanting in the Hawaiian language. And while each voice was a separate voice, unmasked, there was only one voice. And the voice was chanting aloha, aloha nui, aloha nui loa. And
aloha and ola I kawaii.
Mm-hmm.
It's so special.
Yeah,
and thank you for letting me speak for a moment on the radio.
Mahalo ya oe for calling in.
Okay. And from my ancestors to yours across our beautiful watery drop of a planet.
Ai, aloha no.
Mahalo.
Okay, mahalo ahui ho.
So, Kumu, I have learned so many things from you. You know, definitely cultural pieces, and I want to thank you for helping to get me to start to bridge into learning hula. I told you when I had my very first day of learning hula in my early 20s, my Kumu person, who so stayed a friend, I won't name her name on the radio, but she told me, oh, promise me you will never dance. And so I was like, oh, you know, so it's been something I've always felt like, okay, I can't do.
Well, you remember the first day you ever came to look at my hala, I said, oh, put your stuff down, you're going to dance.
Yeah. So, that was good, and we're going to hear from the United Way movement in just a minute, but when we come back, what I would like to talk to you a little bit about is some of the politics and policies and, you know, what your mana'o is on that, what your perspective is, because I get the privilege of seeing you in your area of strength, which you've just given tiny little kernels to. In this discussion, but you have traveled the world much more than what we have spoken about. You have been recognized in many places. You're a beautiful songwriter, and your lay making is so natural, and how you can make something beautiful out of, I don't want to call them the weeds on the side of the road. Weeds is a bad word, but like maybe the overlooked plants, right?
I call them my toys.
Yes, the toys, the overlooked gifts that are right there on the side of the road that you can make something from anything. But I think also that you have words of wisdom and insight into some of the challenges that we have across the world as people are being displaced and as we have high consumerism and a materialistic society, which I call the dominant culture, is, you know, consuming everywhere and creating issues. So those are policies that we struggle with in Kauai and Hawaii. And I just want to get your feeling and ideas mm-hmm. and some senses of what these are. So you are listening to KKCR, Hanalei, K-A-Q-A, Kilauea. This is Felicia and Marshall with Kauai Soapbox. And in the studio with me is Hula Kumu Kauai Iki. And then, could you also say, like, Le Kumu? It seems to me like...
It's Kauai Iki, actually.
What did I just say?
You say Kauai Iki. A lot of people do that sometimes. Kauai Iki, it means little Kauai. I'm named after the island.
Kauai Iki, that's what I meant to say.
There's a place in Waimea Canyon called Kauai Iki, though.
I didn't mean to W it. I mean to V it. I just,
That's all right, Nora.
Okay, so... let's hear about the United Way, and then we're going to be back.
Kauai United Way magnifies every single donation to support 80-plus separate social services. They scan programs thoroughly and regularly to ensure that meaningful services continue to reach Kauai people in need as efficiently as possible. Kauai United Way makes life better for us all.
So...
well, we're back.
So I got all these, you know, I ended up going to meeting after meeting after meeting. And
I got to applaud you for going to all those meetings. You know, I don't have the stamina or strength to even look at them sometimes because, you know, like you said, policy is policy. So
policy is policy.
And it's made by the certain few and not the majority.
Which is what you're pointing out very often, for example, the Charter Review Commission, yeah?
There's, like, the Charter Review Commission, yeah. I will bring that one up, too. Like, I did go yesterday, and I left with a pretty heavy heart. I'll get deeper into that, I think, in a little bit. But, yeah, I was the only person from the public. And what I see when I go to all these different meetings is the people who are in there trying to make policy... It's not an easy job. I'm going to give them, mm-hmm. you know, a lot of credit for that. You're on a board, you're on a committee, you're on a commission, you got to do all this study stuff, and you're looking at very hard problems. And, like, houselessness is a very big one. Like, tomorrow at the county council, really for the next 2 to 3 days, if they get finished on Thursday, they won't do it on Friday, but they're going to be talking. We've been doing this stuff about the general plan update. They're going to be talking about infrastructure, which includes water, sewage, you know, traffic, roads, then water like the groundwater, and also housing, which means also houselessness. We're like 25% housing insecure. So there's those issues. The Board of Land and Natural Resources meeting is coming up with this, you know, redirection of the water, this permit. They're wanting to do a 65-year lease to Kauai Island Utility Cooperative, which is in some ways a front for how the water gets moved over into the Puna District as opposed to, from the Puna District to Lihue, coming from Wailua to Lihue. Actually, it's all Puna.
What do you mean by front?
Well, what I mean by front is that, like, you know, the amount of water that needs to go into those power plants, it's not that much,
right?
And then they could just stick it right back. But really, it goes over into a big reservoir there in Kapaya. And when we look at the general plan update, they want to put 47% of the growth in Lihue. But the only way they can do that is to take the water from Wailua. Mm. And so... they're wanting to put the growth in Lihue and then Kaloa Poipu area, kind of concentrating it down all in that area. And here I'm going to put in a little bit of a snark. Is this is really right? Because like all like having a like hard time with over this Charter Review Commission. The charter is like the constitution of the island or the county. And when they're stacking it with Grove Farm people, Grove Farm is a big private landowner in that area. Grove Farm is a beneficiary of these decisions to redirect the water. And so the person who is the chair of the Charter Review Commission is also the chair of the Kauai Island Utility Cooperative, who also is a paid consultant, I'll put that gently, for Grove Farm. So there's a concentration of issues there. The person who, I won't name names, but is the Department of Hawaiian Homelands agent for Kauai also is a key administrator for KIUC. So it happens that, you know, the Department of Hawaiian Homelands ends up with a solar system on it. You know, the water gets diverted for it. You know, there's just, I don't think it's with an intention of evil, but people naturally are going to work for what works best for them when they're looking at these issues. So all these things sort of overlap. And we even have Governor Ige coming to the Lihue Business Association meeting. I'm going to be at that on Thursday morning. That's at 7:30. But we've got these issues of, like, Kuleana lands coming before the court where the Robinsons are quiet titling a number of parcels there on South and West Kauai. I put up a post of where that is. So we've got a lot of issues on that. We also have the Navy is going to be doing a charrette on their environmental impact statement on the ocean and all the creatures within it and how big the takes are. There, all these things overlap, and even on my list here, I just, your conversation was too important, I wanted to really be able to explore what your life is, but these incarceration issues, the opioid epidemics, there's all these things. I understand we have a caller. Go ahead. What are you going to say?
I didn't mean to interrupt you, Felicia, but I do want to back up to when you said that. You said that KIUC was a front, and I think what you meant was taking the water, there was some sort of...
I meant that when KIUC is the entity that gets the lease, that's a semi-public entity. They get the lease. They get the water. The thing is that the water doesn't return back to the river, really, not fully, before it goes into a big holding pond for the use in Lihue. And that water is processed and by Grove Farm. Aqua Engineers on Grove Farm, both our sewage treatment and our freshwater treatment that goes out to the houses. So when you control the water, you control development. In Hawaiian, vaivai means wealth, vai is water.
Kanavai means law.
Kanavai means law, right. So it's all related and it's all tied together. And so with an absence of malice, it happens that a lot of these commissions are filled with people who maybe have a dual allegiance. And so I get a stomachache over that, and it is a little tough sometimes when I go, especially if I'm the only person, and I'm testifying, and as soon as I'm done testifying, I'm followed up by the lawyer that's basically saying, and who I consider a friend of mine, but basically saying, yeah, but this is an outspoken person, and what she has to say isn't really valid, which is okay. I can take it, you know, but when not a lot of people show up, there's a problem. So we're going to take this caller, and I want to hear what the caller has to say, but I'm going to have that be quick because I really want to hear what Kauai Iki has to share with us about houselessness or just the different policies and the way that cultural practitioners are maybe managed or forced to be working within the community of the dominant culture. Aloha, you're on the air. Thank you for holding. Hello? Are you there?
Sorry, Felicia, the caller was on the phone. I don't know. Caller, are you there?
Are you there? Okay, well, I will have you. Would you have any thoughts on that, Kumu?
On the houselessness issue?
Well, the houselessness issue, or how all of these difficult things tie in together.
Like I was saying, I applaud you for going to these meetings. A lot of times, When I was younger, I used to attend a lot of meetings also. And the one meeting that stands out in my mind was when you were proposing to build that rubbish dump in Kekaha.
Ah, yes.
Yeah.
And that's really where you live.
And that's where my mom still lives there, and my family is from that side. And I remember at that particular meeting, there were only three of us from the community that showed up. It was my mother and I and Jose Bulatao.
Mm.
And we were saying, no, we don't want this in our backyard. And lo and behold, they already decided what was the fate of the rubbish dump that was going to turn into this monstrosity, really. The whole island's rubbish is going to be shipped, or not shipped, trucked to Kekaha. And what about all the stuff that fell along the way, or, you know, what about the smell when the Kona winds come and blow the wind back to Kekaha from that? And, well, I guess thankfully now there's that rubbish dump fund money that the community receives. And that's nice.
But it goes up in firecrackers,
right,
and,
right.
You know,
sometimes,
I mean,
yeah, not...
Not always.
Not always, but some of the things that the money is spent for might be questionable. You know, I really wish that more people would actually come out, and, you know...
And on a rubbish meeting, like when the intention is to move the landfill to Ma'alo area there in Kapaya... And I went to that meeting at King Kamoali'i School, and guess what? You know, like, if that was on the North Shore, I'd tell you what, it would have been packed, and everybody was
spilling
out the doors. And I don't know, it's dominantly a Filipino community there.
So nobody showed up?
Not not very many people.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it is a very polite culture of people.
Right, right.
And I felt shame.
It's not surprising that people won't show up. People in the local community are so busy trying to stay alive, trying to, you know, work to get money to buy food, all this stuff. So they look at it like it's, they don't have time for this, you know, and it's sad to hear and say that there's a lot of apathy in the community that they could give a damn about, you know. What's going to happen, where the rubbish dump is going to be. Build it wherever you want it to, but not in my backyard.
So if we even look at, like, when we're looking at the landfill, and we have, that's a toxin source, actually.
That's
They've
right.
tried to do a pretty good job, but without question, that there's toxins
it's
that go
toxin
in there. There's
site.
A toxin source.
And
especially with these new garbage cans, because the mechanized garbage cans, because when we had human beings going through the garbage as they were dumping it in, mm-hmm. they knew who was tossing paint or who was doing the wrong thing, so they'd set it back down. And now it just kind of goes into a big soup
there,
and it goes into our transfer stations. And it drizzles into the water system,
mm-hmm.
and it's a health risk for our sanitation workers. So it is really, really important that we're responsible with our rubbish. But you guys are in a crucible of toxins. And
that's
so
right. What did they call Kekaha Mill? Was a Superfund site.
Was it really?
Yeah.
It's called a Superfund
site. Then they
site.
Downgraded it to a brownfield.
Yeah. Well, and then you remember when they found that poison in the... No, the poison in the dirt here at Kilauea?
Oh, yeah. And then we threw it away there.
Then you guys shipped it all the way from Kilauea to Kekaha. So all along the way, who knows where somebody breathed some of that stuff in.
And I felt bad because they scooped it out of our town.
Yeah.
And went and threw it in his town.
Yeah. But Kekaha is full of toxins already. The mill area is full of lead and asbestos. There's across the area there. And I used to work at the school, which now is housed
The Ni'i House School.
Yeah. Kula'aupuni. It's housed in the old plantation offices.
Right next to the
mm-hmm.
toxin site. Yeah.
Right. The most toxin site is right across the street where the old service station was.
We did a number of shows on this a few
mm-hmm.
years back because it really was a Superfund site. It is adjacent to a school.
Right.
There is a triangling of toxicity.
Right.
And you said, like, in high school, you used to spray poison, right? You were poison spray?
Yeah. I worked in the plantation, spraying Sabi Dong, they called that. And what it was that Roundup stuff. We spread Roundup all over the banks and in between the fields and along the waterways. Yeah.
And how old were you?
I was either 17 or 18, I believe.
And did you have protection equipment on?
Well, we had long pants and we wore gloves. They gave us those little paper
masks
to put over our noses, but nobody wore them.
And then?
We had glasses. Nobody wore them.
And you started having diabetes at 30-something?
Yeah.
And so these are degenerative illnesses, and then there's quite a few kids in your family.
Yeah.
But a number of you have...
Yeah, we all have diabetes. Our parents have it. Our grandparents had it. So we inherited all of that.
Or is it that you all are sitting there eating the same fish from the same stream bed that's right downstream?
I'm
going to
tell you that in those ditches that come out of the mill... One of the ditches goes around the back of the school and around the town and pours out at first ditch and second ditch. Well, there's mercury and arsenic in those ditches. And then one of the ditches used to flow right out to sea along St. Teresa's School, St. Teresa's Church, and pour out right onto the reef there. As children, we all swam in that polluted water.
Right. So when I see that, because you and I are just about the same age, I'm class of 80 also,
mm-hmm.
And you have mobility issues.
Yeah. Well, now I have, neuropathy in my hands and my feet, nerve damage in my hands and feet. You know, I sometimes have this feeling because, you know, we ate out of those streams and ditches. They used to have what they call that paltot or catfish that lived in there. We used to go there, fish that, and we used to eat that from the very same ditches. The what else was in there? Tilapia and all that stuff. Yeah.
So when you have this early exposure, I just, like, because of this show that I do, Kauai Soapbox, where we have the difficult task of exploring some of these challenging issues, in getting to know you and seeing all these amazing gifts that you have, but also seeing how you are right in the crosshairs of the challenges that we've been looking at, whether that is systemic poisoning or health challenges from a young age, and having housing crises.
Right.
And we've been
talking. Who can afford the houses nowadays? There's no place in Kekaha. I was a full-time school teacher, and I couldn't afford any place in Kekaha.
So do you have insights and thoughts about how we can, or what would be the right way to address the housing, or if you were even testifying in this moment to the council
what would your word be? I would say, if the council is all this and that, then remember that thing. You are your brother's keeper. So have all your brothers and sisters in mind when you make this decisions first and foremost. And try to include them, you know, because just because they're not there, that doesn't mean that they don't have something to say.
Right. And then, but would you see, like, what do you see, do you have the opportunity to see what the houseless are facing?
But it's a monumental thing that they're facing. It's like a huge wave coming to crash on them because they can't stop this wave from crashing on them.
People who are without housing.
The people who are without housing.
So what does that wave look like? Is it the park ranger or the drugs or what is it?
You know. It's everything, not just one thing. I mean, there's so many things that affect those people and that community. Yeah? Just the day-to-day survival, how they're going to put the food on the plates and all of that. I mean, we've always had to supplement. I grow a garden, and if you couldn't grow a garden at home, well, then there are gardens planted everywhere around town, in between here and there, where people actually farm and grow stuff on without anybody's permission. And if you go to cacao side, you see that there's people are planting and growing stuff in land that's not theirs, but they just, nobody is doing nothing with the land. So they've just taken the step and gone and done that. You know, then taking the situation into their own hands. Now, if DLNR tell, I remember DLNR, that one time we tried to start a garden in Kekaha Park, and they were going to come and bulldoze our garden. We had the permission of the park supervisor, who was like an auntie to me. She said, okay, yeah, you guys can plant stuff over here. We did, and when we did that, people started to complain that we were doing this, but we actually had the permission of the park supervisor, but because it didn't go through the mayor and because it didn't go through here and there, they're going to tear our garden apart, and that's what they did. They tore our garden apart. The garden was being just like, and it was the same time the mayor had just planted his garden, his victory garden by the convention hall, so we're following suit. Of what
right.
he was doing. You know, he was encouraging everybody to grow vegetables and food, and that's what we were doing. But when we started to do that, our hands were tied again.
And that kind of overlapped a death that happened, right, in the garden there?
Well, like, kind of, you know.
Crosses,
there was an old man that, it was, you know, he wanted to do something to help the community. And he was an older senior person. I don't want to mention his name,
okay.
but he was well-loved or hated by from people, but, you know, he tried to actually make something out of nothing, and he did. Some of the plants that he planted there are still growing, actually, but a lot of the plants, when they wanted to tear the garden apart, I mean, people came from the community and dug it out and took it home.
Right, I remember that. And at the top of the hour, Jazz with John will be on.
Well, right, we had a caller who wanted to express that he loves the show, thanks very much, but feels like we have more difficulties, problems, challenges enunciated than we do solutions, and would love to hear more in the way of solutions. So we could ask for that from callers, 826-7774. And Felicia, you sometimes have solutions.
Well, I know that, like, what will be somewhat presented tomorrow.
Yeah.
From the community to the council that maybe has been underpresented in the general plan update. I think just because of oversight, most of the people who do participate aren't people who are without housing.
Mm-hmm.
That's the challenge, is that the people who have the time to go help
mm-hmm.
don't have the actual experience of the problem. So some of the things that we're looking at, certainly we've talked about many times how to do tiny houses like on farms. That's one way of addressing some of this. Another piece that I've been starting to talk about lately and really just getting a better look at where it's happening across the United States and in the world, because there's 7 billion plus of us, where probably when John Gordon was born, there might have been 2 billion. I don't know how many, but we have gotten so many people now. Is the micro units for, it's not
mm-hmm.
perfect, but like taking a lot of these abandoned commercial spaces, can we make it work out so there's 300 or 450 square foot little units in there? It's not meant for somebody forever. Maybe there's a few people who would like that because they have very simple needs, just a good place to crash. You can make it cute. Like some of these places are pretty swank that we're seeing. But for the emerging generation, that is who is really having the hardest time, because they've got these huge debts for education. They really have had a rougher time than certainly yours, mine, and Marshall's generation, where we were able to get educated. If we had a debt, it was buying the first house, not just simply getting an education. So I think that looking at those micro units, because there are buildings in a lot of the different communities, you can make it cute. How do we make it hip, happy, and healthy to do that? Those are some solutions. When we look at what came up last week was something called safe zones. Mel Raposo had suggested at least like at Vindinha Stadium, letting people park unharassed overnight to sleep in their cars, to be able to use the showers. I was at Tim Bynum's park dedication this weekend. The Kamalani Kai Bridge is now the Bynum Bridge. And there's good bathrooms there with showers, and there's tents. And I can tell that there are people who are basically living there. And, you know, somewhere we have to allow people to be able to do it. I think if we have safe zones as an emergency stopgap, but then we're able to get some of these transition housing that might be for a couple of years.
Well, you know, several years ago, I was homeless too, and I'm still houseless. I would go to the neighborhood centers, and they have neighborhood centers throughout the island. And each of these neighborhood centers, there were showers installed. So if people needed to take a shower, you could take a shower. But then after years of not going there, when I finally went back and took a shower, we were reprimanded. You can't take a shower here because I don't know when they changed the policy to make it that you had to rent or reserve the center before you could use the shower, because prior to that, the county worker told me straight out, if you need to shower, you can come here and shower. And then I went back there again, and the custodian said, oh, no, you can't use the showers. And then now I see them with this sign saying, unless we are renters or users of this thing, that
really
we can't use the showers. The showers are there. We just got to look at them. The county built them for nothing for us to just look at, or I guess we got to rent the unit. It was really kind of stifling to me that happened.
And that, like, the county building, they locked the bathrooms a few years back, and they locked some of the different park bathrooms, and there's a new policy where they can close the parks at night at will that just started October 12th. And what comes up also is places where people are urinating or pooping on sidewalks or around the backs of buildings, and they get mad at the people who have no place to live, but they need to get mad at the public facilities that get closed because of it.
Where are the public facilities after hours? Are there any places, like you said, are there safe places? Yes, let's make safe places. Let's build parks and bathrooms where people can use them 24/7 if they need to, because it's like I said, it's a problem everywhere. There are people all over the place. I lived in Honolulu, for instance, and at the time I lived there, I was not homeless, but I knew a lot of homeless people. I lived in Chinatown. There was a tent city in Ala Park. People started living in the park. Now they live on a sidewalk anywhere, and there's no place for people to go. Where do you go after they kick you out from one sidewalk? You just go to the next sidewalk.
And the thing is when people have a debilitating illness, or they are disabled, or they've gotten cancer, I guess that's a debilitating illness.
Even harder.
And so a lot of times that is what creates this transition to losing the housing. Mm-hmm. Plus, of course, the houses sell. Like, people who pay their rent all the time, the house sells, turns into vacation rental, or it turns into...
Or, a year later, each year they want to raise the rent. You know, I feel sorry for one of my daughters. She was paying, a nice fee. It was a small room, and then now the rent for that small room went from $600 to $800, which is even harder for her.
So we're going to hear one last very quick comment, then we're going to say aloha. We're going to go to the county council report. I see somebody's waiting on the phone. I can't take you. Okay, go ahead, Marshall.
Yes, the caller wanted to suggest that the parks may be closed at night because of illegal activity, including graffiti. And he actually suggested that there's a political agenda behind that. But we don't have much time to go into that.
Right, but that has been deeply discussed at the council. Thank you so much, Kumu Kawaiiiki.
Hi, Malia'oi.
And Jazz with John is coming up. Thank you, Marshall, for taking the calls.
Thank you, Felicia. Thank you, Kumu, for coming
aloha,
in.
Aloha.
Aloha, everyone.
Okay, and Jazz with John is coming up. KKCR, Hanalei, KAQA, Kilauea, and here is the county council report.